I'm Hillary McClure, Multimedia Director at Cybercrime Magazine. I'm here today with Karen Elizari, an internationally recognized security analyst, researcher, author, and speaker who works with leading security firms, government organizations, and Fortune 500 companies. You can find Karen on Twitter, LinkedIn, and her website, k3r3n3.com. Welcome, Karen. So great to have you with us today.
Thank you, Hillary. It's my pleasure. Happy to join you today on the podcast. It's a lot of fun to have conversations with people as passionate about cybersecurity as I am. So thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, absolutely. And speaking of passion, Karen, I have to start off by saying that I watched the YouTube video you recently did with Insider, which was titled Hacker Rates, 12 Hacking Scenes in Movies and TV, How Real Is It? And it was just so fun. Can you tell us, our listeners, a little about the scenes that you rated and what types of things you were looking for as a hacker and an expert in cybersecurity?
Yeah, it was so much fun to do the video for Business Insider. The How Real Is It series, it's really part of a genre. There's a lot of videos on YouTube like this, where they bring in experts to analyze media scenes with particular capabilities or particular aspects that are taking place. For example, they brought in like a Secret Service agent to look at Secret Service agents protecting presidents in media and film. And they wanted me to talk as a hacker about how realistic hacking scenes are when we see them in the movies and in TV shows that we love. And for me, it was such a treat because I do enjoy so much watching movies and television shows about hacking. You know, some people in our industry don't enjoy it. I usually do. And it's kind of funny how you see really the entire spectrum of productions where in some places the hacking is basically indistinguishable from magic, to paraphrase Arthur C. Clarke, where the hacking is really just used to kind of further the plot in some way. And it's very, very abstract. And the hackers are pretty much all capable wizards. And they're usually also the bad guys. And in other types of, you know, films and TV shows, the hackers really are the heroes and they have motivations and they use realistic tools and they have nuanced characters. And I really enjoyed working on that YouTube video with Business Insider. If you haven't seen it yet, I hope people get a chance to watch it. But some of the scenes that we worked on didn't make the cut. So I actually watched hours and hours and hours of television and film, and out of which, you know, we had to cut, you know, maybe 25 minutes of content. I could easily have done that for a week, probably, because I am an avid consumer of media. And in fact, the whole reason I am a hacker and the reason I made it into the security industry was because of a Hollywood movie, because of the 1995 film Hackers. And, you know, how realistic was that film? Maybe not that realistic, but to me, the characters in it, the way they made choices, their ideologies, their lifestyle, that's what spoke to me. And that was, I believe, fairly realistic in the sense that the characters were based on real world hackers that the movie makers had conversations with, and they went to real life hacker conferences back in the 90s when they really made the movie. So they captured that hacker ethic or the hacker lifestyle, and that was real to me. Although the hacking in the movie Hackers maybe is not the most realistic, or perhaps was not the most realistic in 1995, today we do see hackers doing things kind of similar to what we saw in that film. Like, for example, taking over an oil tanker. So just the past... just in the past couple of days, a cyber criminal group used a ransomware virus to basically cause an oil company to stop, I wouldn't say stop production, but really stop the operations of their oil pipeline. So guess what? The Hackers movie didn't get it so wrong. They were only just, you know, maybe 25 years ahead of their time. If you imagine that the film actually had one of the first cases of ransomware virus in history, because the hackers in the movie had to deal with the Da Vinci virus, which threatened to capsize an oil tanker if it's not paid $1 million. So that's, you know, these are the types of things I look for when I look at hacker scenes in movie and television. I try to see, firstly, what's the hacker's motivations? Are they the bad guys? Are they the good guys? How complex is it? I try to look at the tools, the techniques, the capabilities that they have, and whether these are similar to what we see in the real world, what security researchers use in the real world. And I also like to see, you know, where the movie makers used it as a plot device and where the hacking is really something that's front and center stage. And I wish I could do another video like that. It was so much fun. I could probably do that for ages. It's so much fun to look at that.
Yeah, that was so much fun. You did such an excellent job. And I think people really do, you know, you mentioned that you enjoy the movies. I enjoy the movies. One of our most popular pieces of media at Cybercrime Magazine is our complete list of hacker and cybersecurity movies. So obviously we're not alone, but you'll have to look at that and let us know if there's anything that we're forgetting since you're so, you know, in that space as well. But it's interesting to me that you mention how Angelina Jolie's character Acid Burn in the movie Hackers inspired you to become who you are today. And I want to have you tell us a little bit about your impressive career, but I quickly wanted to touch upon how she was probably one of the first hackers in, you know, big cinema that we saw at that time in 95. You know, later on we had Trinity and The Matrix, but it's really interesting that representation, you know, that really resonated with you and kind of showed you like, hey, you could do this as a woman. You know, you don't have to be a dude in a hoodie to do this.
Absolutely. And I think that's why media is important, because it doesn't just entertain us or educates us and helps us pass the time. In some cases, it really shows us what reality looks like or what reality can look like, right? That's the role of fiction to me. That's why science fiction has always really inspired me, because it shows us things that are possible. And for me, the representation in the film Hackers, it was Angelina Jolie, a young woman, a character I could relate with. And the group of hackers that she was a part of was very multicultural. It was quite diverse. You know, there was even a character that maybe today we would have called non-binary, because one of the hackers, you know, actually several of the hackers wear makeup, they wear nail polish, they dress up really interestingly. And I had the privilege recently of meeting with the person who curated the fashion and the costume for the movies.
Oh, that's so cool.
For Hackers. So the actual costumes, the actual props for Hackers. And he is extremely cool. And he's this very, very cool dude from London. And he was really in touch with the punk scene and with the drag queen scene and the alternative scenes and the 90s in London and New York. And he really tapped into those countercultural elements to bring them in, to really showcase how hackers represent an alternative lifestyle, not just very knowledgeable and very intuitive with their approach to technology, but also very subversive in their approach to what is normal, what is mainstream, etc. So it was much more interesting than just a hoodie, right? And that really captured my attention. And today, I think that's part of the role of media, is to represent what's possible, the entire spectrum of people and representations that we can see in the hacker world, in the cybersecurity world. And if you attend any hacker conferences in person, hopefully soon, or virtually, I think you'll notice that our community is changing, it's growing, it's inclusive now of so many more types of people from different backgrounds, people that grew up as hackers like I did, you know, when I was 13, or people that are now in their 40s and 50s and they're now entering the cybersecurity world. And that's also exciting to me, because it's cool to see how our community is growing.
Absolutely. That is really cool. I'm glad you made all of those points. Excellent points. And, you know, as a woman, you're from Israel, as a young woman watching that movie that inspired you to become who you are today, and you're so well known in our community. You were the first Israeli woman to give a TED Talk in 2014. I know that you could probably tell us about your career for a very long time, but do you want to maybe just give us a brief overview of kind of what you've done and what you're going to do, and also how that experience of giving a TED Talk was? I'm curious to hear that. But first, just kind of go over your career for us, because it is so impressive.
Sure, absolutely. So probably that TED Talk was a life-changing moment. So I could talk to you about my life before TED and after. But I'll just start at the beginning. I was lucky enough to see that movie. I was lucky enough to be curious about technology and to have access to that technology, have access to the internet, have my own computer, have access to computer education, to computer classes in my school, and later on, in my community in Tel Aviv in the early 90s, mid 90s. Even today, not every young girl has access to a technical education or a computer of her own. So I was very lucky, I think, to grow up. More than that, in Israel, we didn't have a computer crime law until about 1998, which basically means a lot of the things I did in the mid early 90s are not technically illegal because there wasn't really a law, at least in my country, against them. Also, I was under 18 at the time. But when I did turn 18, that's when I joined the Israeli military, like most men and women do here in Israel. And I was, again, I think, quite privileged to be able to, you know, come up on the very first day. I got my boots, I got my uniform, I got my shots, they took a photo of me. And then an officer asked me, okay, you, Karen, what's your story? And that officer had a pile, you know, folders upon folders of people's files, their high school scores, their aptitude tests, personal interviews, security clearance, all of those pieces of information. But he looked up at me and looked in my eyes and said, "What's your story?" And for 20 seconds, I could tell him how passionate I am about hacking and cybersecurity, and now that's what I want to do as a career. And he sent me to a unit within the Israeli military where I could actually develop those skills and build them up to become helpful skills in the security context. So not just using the adversarial mindset, the hacker mindset, to poke fingers at problems, but also to try and develop strategies and solutions and security tools for the military, focusing on obviously the communication technologies and the problems that the military was faced with. After my military service, I worked for a variety of organizations, small and large, mostly on the larger side, I have to say. So I worked for PricewaterhouseCoopers in Israel. I worked for AT&T in Israel. For a certain time between 6 p.m. and 9 a.m., I was network operations for AT&T in Israel. It was a long time ago, but I learned so much. I learned so much working for these big organizations, and they really completed my education. So I learned about military technologies. I learned about ISP and communication service providers, technologies and infrastructure. And I learned about financial technologies as I worked with PwC, and we did security testing and assessments for a lot of the big banks in Israel and the big government agencies in Israel. So I really had a pretty solid career in that space for, almost 10 years, I think. And around 2012, I got the opportunity to teach cybersecurity at an organization in California called Singularity University, which is not really a university, and it's not just about the singularity. So the name is a little bit misleading, but it was a really interesting experience because it was kind of like an executive MBA program where students from all over the world would come in for 10 weeks to learn about emerging technologies and develop new companies, new startups, and new business models. And I was there to teach security challenges and to talk to them about how new technologies have security issues and how that comes into play in a variety of ways. And it was a very interesting experience for me because it really opened my mind from what was happening and what was possible in the Israeli cybersecurity ecosystem to what was happening globally and how entrepreneurs were looking at cybersecurity and how I believed, a lot of people were also missing a big part of the picture. And for me, that big part of the picture was the hackers and how friendly hackers and individual hackers and hacktivist groups and movements are very, very influential, more influential than most people realized back then. At least that was my point of view. So I started speaking about that on a variety of platforms, academic organizations, meetups, non-conferences or unconferences, as they were called at the time. And I was essentially scouted at one of these unconferences in Nazareth in northern Israel. And I was wearing the anonymous mask and talking about the power and the influence of Anonymous as a hacktivist movement and how it, really became very distributed and a lot of different people took on the Anonymous brand to use it for a variety of other hacktivist roles and causes. And I was really sharing my passion about researching and learning this community. Unbeknownst to me, an executive producer from TED was sitting in the front row listening to me the whole time. And she was in Israel to essentially look for new and interesting voices to feature at the international main TED conference, because a year after that, that conference that she came to was the 30th anniversary of TED. So she was really looking for interesting people, and she was scouting out speakers a year in advance. And I didn't know that I was basically being, it was almost like The Masked Singer, where I was being auditioned as a speaker and I had a mask on. It was a very surreal experience. And it's not like she came up to me right after the speech and she said, "Karen, great talk, come on TED." But rather a couple months later, she reached out to me and she invited me to speak at TED. And to me, that was a really life-changing moment, because I realized it was a global platform to share my point of view about the role of hackers and how it's going to be a much more, even more powerful role than people realize. So for that 16-minute TED Talk, I prepared for about 9 months, where I had really the privilege of preparing for 9 months. I took time away from my academic duties with Tel Aviv University, my research, my work duties, and I just focused on that and using those 16 minutes in the best way possible to convey my message that hackers represent an incredible force for change, for good and for bad, and that there is potential there if we can harness it. And that's what I called in my TED Talk, using hackers, or looking at hackers as a digital immune system for the information age. And I still believe that's true. In fact, I think now we see that coming into play even more, because individual hackers in their role as bug hunters, for example, in bug bounty programs, have really been stepping up in the past few years. And they're uncovering vulnerabilities, oftentimes vulnerabilities that are more critical and more difficult to find than whatever the companies that they help can find themselves. So they're really covering that organizational blind spot. And that's something I've dedicated some time to looking at, the way the phenomenon of bug bounty programs has really evolved in the past few years. It's part of my academic research work at Tel Aviv University, and it's something I'm very passionate about sharing as well. So TED really helped me by firstly offering me that platform, but also by requiring me to really focus my message on that. And that's what I've been focused on since then, really my research work and my speaking, my writing, my advisory, my nonprofits are all about what hackers can contribute and how hackers can help us build a safer future. And I hope that doesn't sound too grand a vision, but that's what I'm really passionate about.
No, I mean, I think it sounds very genuine, because you are so passionate, and it doesn't sound like something too grand coming from you at all. And you mentioned earlier the what we're seeing happening recently with the Colonial Pipeline. And a couple of months ago, our editor-in-chief, Steve Morgan, hosted our first cyber warfare roundtable. And it was discussed how businesses, both in the public and private sectors, either have been or will be hacked. And I know that you're such an expert on the age of cyber warfare. And so with everything that we've been seeing, and, you know, obviously, you just mentioned blind spots that companies have. Obviously, we're really seeing what those are with everything that's been happening with Sunburst as well. Kind of what are you seeing? And in your opinion, what does the future, you know, what's trending? What's kind of like ahead for us with cyber warfare?
So it's very kind of you to call me an expert on cyber warfare. I don't know that I'm an expert, but definitely I've had a front row seat. Because, you know, living and working in Israel and working with both government agencies and private sector companies here in Israel for the past 20 years has really provided me with that front row seat to see how cyber warfare really emerged and has become probably the most useful tool for a politician. So that's I think what we're seeing. We're seeing that there are certain nation states out there in the world that have really seized on the potential of using cyber capabilities to shape strategy, to shape politics. And in this, when I'm saying this, I'm referring both to, you know, even to Stuxnet, which is probably the harbinger of the age of cyber warfare. Stuxnet as a, you know, cyber weapon, 15,000 lines of code, was a tool to shape global strategy. It was a tool to prevent nuclear armament, which is something that's right now, you know, people are sitting in rooms and are trying to come up with treaties and agreements and diplomatic sanctions to either allow or disallow or somehow control nuclear armament in Iran. Stuxnet was just another tool to achieve the same goal. In the same way, I see cyber warfare right now on the global stage as a tool that certain nation states, certain politicians have realized can be some of the most useful tool, useful in the sense of the return on investment. You spend $1 million or a couple millions of dollars on the development of exploits and on hiring the best hackers that you can and giving them the best intelligence and the best infrastructure that you can. And they in turn can create a very, very useful cyber capability for you as a leader to help shape the world to your liking. And of course, this is now playing out between nation states with different ideologies, between the US and its adversaries, between Israel and its adversaries, between, in some cases, even with terrorist groups. So this is, I think, what we're going to see in the future. It's not going to go anywhere. In fact, I think we're going to see the use of cyber capabilities, offensive cyber capabilities, more and more. Probably Sunburst was just the latest example of that. And we're going to see it play out in a variety of ways. The difference between cyber warfare and more traditional forms of warfare is that it plays out on a civilian battlefield, which is basically technology companies and the internet. And that civilian battlefield is where all of us live and where all of us do business and where all of us consume entertainment and where all of us run our lives on. So that is the main, I think, from my point of view, as I look at the future, that's the main conflict point. That's the tension. And I see, you know, the current US administration trying to come up with different tools, different strategies to deter cyber adversaries, to maybe go after cyber adversaries much more aggressively than in the past. And I do welcome that, but I do also question whether we all realize how the civilian battlefield has become really the primary scene for what should be seen as national geopolitical conflict. To me, it's very interesting as an academic researcher. As an individual, as a civilian, it's also concerning. So I look at it from a few perspectives. And again, it's where I want to highlight and say it's not just about the military generals and the politicians. It's about all of us. And perhaps cybersecurity is too big of a deal, too strategic of a deal to be left only to government agencies and military generals. It should be something that also has some form of civilian oversight or control over. And this is, you know, this is my soapbox and I'll stand on it.
And is that where you think hacktivism, as you mentioned earlier, like can come into play? And is that why you founded B-Sides Tel Aviv, Israel's largest hacker community? Do you think that's kind of where civilians can step in and step up to the plate and help?
That's a very generous assumption, Hillary. But the truth is, I started B-Sides Tel Aviv because I participated in B-Sides Las Vegas and I just saw how powerful that community is. And I had a chance to do it in Israel and I had a chance to give back, to really provide a platform and a stage for the security researchers and the hackers and the hacktivists in Israel that, you know, might not be able to travel all the way to Las Vegas. And maybe their voice isn't heard because they're not that well known. Maybe they're shy, a variety of reasons. So B-Sides Tel Aviv really came in to serve the local community. And for me, it's a way to give back. So I spend about 30% of my time on nonprofit work, which includes running B-Sides Tel Aviv, which is a registered nonprofit in Israel, and the Leading Cyber Ladies Network, which is a global movement for women in cybersecurity that was started right here in Israel about 6 years ago when 20 of us, 20 ladies in cybersecurity, gathered together in northern Tel Aviv. And today it's a network of meetups with women from all over the world, the US, Canada, Europe, the UK, soon in the Far East, and we've got almost 2,000 members. So if you're listening and you're a lady in cybersecurity, you're very welcome to seek us out on our website, Leading Cyber Ladies, and to join us in one of our local meetups or virtually, globally, anywhere in the world. You're welcome. That's why I started these movements, Hillary, because I wanted to give back to the community that I grew up in. And I wanted to change the picture. I'll never forget my first hacker conference in the year 2000, which was called Y2Hack. It was a play on Y2K. Mm. And I showed up at this hacker conference in Tel Aviv. It was Tel Aviv's first hacker conference as a volunteer. And it was 348 guys and me and the woman who was running it. But there was one woman who was running it. And yeah. her presence there meant for me, I have a place in this community. Mm. And that's why I'm running B-Sides Tel Aviv and the Leading Cyber Ladies.
Well, that's incredible. And we'll have to have you back to talk about Leading Cyber Ladies more, because women in cyber are such an important initiative for us here. So I think that's something we share. But Karen, this has just been so wonderful. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing your knowledge. And it was just such a pleasure speaking with you today.
Thank you so much, Hillary. It was my pleasure as well. And I want to wish everybody, wherever they are in the world, wellness, health, safety, and hack the planet.
Thanks so much, Karen.
Thank you. Thank you, Hillary.
I'm Hillary McClure, Multimedia Director at Cybercrime Magazine. Joining me today was Karen Elazari, an internationally recognized security analyst, researcher, author, and speaker who works with leading security firms, government organizations, and Fortune 500 companies. You can find Karen on Twitter, LinkedIn, and her website, k3r3n3.com. And you can listen to all of our podcast episodes by visiting cybercrime.radio.